Psalm 91. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God, in whom I trust. For he will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a buckler. I will not fear the terror of the night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in darkness, nor the destruction that wastes at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. You will only look with your eyes and see the recompense of the wicked. Because you have made the Lord your dwelling place, the Most High, who is my refuge, no evil shall be allowed to befall you, no plague come near to your tent. For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. On their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone. You will tread on the lion and the adder, the young lion and the serpent you will trample underfoot. Because he holds fast to me in love, I will deliver him. I will protect him because he knows my name. When he calls to me, I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will rescue him and honor him. With long life, I will satisfy him and show him my salvation.
I want to just begin by thanking you, all of you at Horizon, for these invitations over these last 3 weeks. It's been truly my joy and my pleasure to bring God's word to you, and it's especially so to bring them to such dear friends. Thank you too for all those who have thought about us in this past week. You'd think that when you get to somewhat older age that these things may not affect you, but unfortunately age has no difference in these things, and so I'm really very thankful for your thoughts and your messages and for your prayers. In the December of 1941, a young girl in her teens sat crouched with her sisters and her mother in a duck pond as Japanese fighter bombers flew overhead in an attack which signaled Japan's engagement in her southern campaign to occupy Burma, or modern-day Myanmar. And to the best that I've been able to ascertain, that frightening event took place in Tavoy, a small town just south of Rangoon, or modern-day Yangon, Burma's capital city, or Rangoon itself. And as the bombs were released and shook the ground when they hit it and exploded, the young girl in that duck pond began to quote and repeat over and over again the substance of this 91st Psalm. The sisters of that young girl have often confirmed that story, and also their recollection of their own amazement at how she was able to remember and recite those verses, though in particular, apparently over and over again, verse 7, 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. And it seems that young girl had assimilated the falling of these things as the bombs. They would not come near her. Well, the family escaped that bombardment with their lives, and they endured the perils of the Japanese invasion and the course of the war. So that young girl, who incidentally was my mother, lived to a ripe 96 years of age. And while at the end of her life she was not able to remember that frightening event from her youth, the one who she took shelter under, in the shelter of that duck pond, never forgot his promises to her. Because God satisfied her with long life and showed her his salvation. And just as he planted the promise of his protection in her heart and then satisfied her with long life, so did he, we can say with all assurance, based on God's faithfulness, honor her with the fullness of his salvation when she entered into his presence this last week. The point of the illustration being whether to the psalmist in his day or to God's people in our day, God never fails to keep his promises in time and unto eternity. So let's look then at this wonderful psalm of assurance of God's promises. And let's consider it under three broad headings. God, a shelter, God's sure promises, and then God's perspective. So firstly then, God, a shelter. And the first thing I want to bring to your attention as to how God is revealed as a shelter in this psalm concerns the names the psalmist used of God in it. And did you notice in the reading of the psalm that in just the first two verses, no less than four names of God are used in it? Verse 1, he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. Then verse 2, I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress. And then, my God, in whom I trust. Four names. Isn't it amazing how we can so casually glide over these details when we're not looking? So, why did the psalmist use four names for God? Was it for stylistic purposes, for literary diversity, for poetry? Well, without doubt, that's at least part of the answer. After all, the Psalms are the outpouring of many of the inspired poets' hearts. And if you were to gather together all the great works of poetry and compare them, surely the Book of Psalms would have to be the absolute pinnacle of human expression, wouldn't it? And whatever we may admire about the works of such people as Shakespeare, Edgar Allan Poe, Emily Dickinson, William Wordsworth, or Dylan Thomas, or any of the great poets, surely at the very top of the pile must stand the Psalter with its truly divinely inspired poets. So undoubtedly, there has to be some sense of poetic ingenuity that lies behind the reason for the psalmist using the names of God as he did. After all, that's what being borne along by the Spirit infers in the doctrine of inspiration. That the Spirit somehow comes upon a person and uses their personality and their gifts to convey God's truths to him. But if we were to stop our answer there, then we certainly wouldn't be biblically competent in our assessment. And that's because every biblical student knows that names in the Bible mean something. That in the Bible, people's names often express traits or details of their life experience, which then often becomes descriptive of a person in their name. And so just a simple look, for example, at changes of men like Abram to Abraham and what that inferred. Or Jacob, who became Israel. Or even Esau, which means red and was descriptive of his skin color, which show us that these were men whose names described something about them, from trite details to very profound details. And the same goes with those names which God reveals himself by. They express certain aspects, characteristics, or attributes of God. They mean something. And in the first two verses of Psalm 91, there are four descriptive names for God given. They mean something. So let's look at them quickly. And the first name that we find is the name Most High. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High. Now, the Hebrew word that lies behind this is the word Elyon. And it may surprise some of us here that to learn that Elyon is actually derived from the word Allah, which means to go up. So here it expresses something like God lifted up, or God highly exalted, God perhaps in heaven. Derek Kidner, in his commentary on the Psalms, says that using this context in Psalm 91 expresses a title that cuts every threat down to size. Every threat is as nothing before God lifted up. So the psalmist, speaking of dwelling under the shelter of the one who is high and exalted and under whom there is no opposition, is the one that the psalmist takes shelter in. Then the word Almighty. I will abide in the shadow of Shaddai, the Almighty. Now, in the area of language and the etymology of words, sometimes words can have varied meanings or two meanings, and Shaddai is a word like that. But without going into details, it should be suffice to say that we're on safe grounds to suggest that the word basically means to be powerful, possessing power over all creation. So the psalmist says that God is highly exalted, that he's almighty. But then he also infers something special in the way he expresses this. And notice his subtle emphasis on his nearness to God. Because to be in God's shadow, just like abiding in his shelter, means to be near to him, to be close to him. And you can't be in someone's shadow or take shelter under them without being very near to them, can you? So we could say that the psalmist is saying something like this, that God is most exalted and almighty, and that the psalmist himself abides under the shadow of his mighty throne, the throne which rules over all creation. Something what the psalmist is saying. Then in verse 2, I will say to the Lord, or Yahweh, I will say to Yahweh, the name most often expressed, used in the context of covenantal relationship, and which implies God's unchanging relationship with his people, his unchanging purposes to do good to his people. And that means that the psalmist lives near to and speaks to God. That's how close this arrangement is. That even though God is the almighty ruler, yet because of his gracious covenant, he can be boldly approached and spoken to. I will say to Yahweh, he says. And then, my God, in whom I trust. And this fourth name, here is the name Elohim. The name, again, that's associated with almighty power. It's the name associated with creation in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. In the beginning, Elohim created the heavens and the earth. Though the emphasis, generally speaking, is of that almighty power over all creation, which is subservient to his workings of grace. That's the general context we find that. Or the almighty power that orders all things in heaven and earth to the purposes of earth's own workings for grace for his people. But then, that aside, notice here the psalmist's use of the personal, my God, his God. The mighty one he knows and trusts and speaks to is his God. So what's the psalmist saying here in this quadruple expression of the names of God? Well, I think he's saying something like this, that God is the omnipotent God who decreed all creation. And that he's also the omnipotent God who rules over all creation. And he's also the immanent God, and especially nearby those who are his own. And that this majestic God is his shelter from life's troubles, his refuge from the enemy, his fortress to secure and to defend him. And the Lord, who in the first place promised to be faithful to him in all of those things in covenant faithfulness. So these are the names of God which the psalmist used to describe God as a shelter. But the next method, if you like, the psalmist uses to illustrate God as a shelter, as his shelter, is one which seems to border on comical irreverence, at least to my little twisted mind. And the description or picture that the psalmist presents for us here is that of a God as a mighty chicken. Or perhaps more correctly, as a militant mother hen. And verse 3 speaks of the fowler's snare, and it speaks of a chicken being trapped to be eaten, roasted. But verse 4, more specifically, he will cover you with his pinions or feathers, and under his wings you will find refuge. And then his faithfulness is a shield and buckler. So dividing that up, God is firstly seen as a protective mother hen, anxious to keep her precious chicks under the safety of her wings. And you may have noticed in passing that this picture of a mother hen is a wonderfully complementary illustration to what the psalmist has been saying about God in the names he expressed of him in verses 1 and 2. And that's probably very intentional, because it's very possible when we study the doctrine of God, as when we consider the names of God, to end up in our minds with a God so powerful, so perfectly righteous, so high, so immense, that we see him in our minds as fearful and cold and stern and hard and unapproachable. A God who, quite frankly, would be the very last place anyone would want to take refuge under. But the psalmist beautifully complements verses 1 and 2 with verse 4, with God, the gentle, loving, caring, protecting mother hen watching over her chicks. So he says that this most high, sovereign, ruler God then is also the kind, gentle, loving, anxious God to protect his children. But then, so as to not lose sight of what he wanted to emphasize, the psalmist also says that this clucky mother hen has teeth. She wields both shield and buckler, the large shield to defend against the large blows, a static barrier, and the smaller buckler, generally worn on the soldier's arm, to deflect any of the more dynamic attacks. And this mother hen is armed to protect her chicks from the enemy, from whatever direction they might choose to launch their attack. So we've considered then, briefly, what the psalmist means when he spoke of God being a shelter, both by the use of the names of God and also by the illustration of the militant mother hen. And so now let's secondly consider God's sure promises. And now, in considering God's promises, the first thing to notice about the hen's defensive weaponry is that it embodies God's faithfulness. His faithfulness is a shield and buckler. His faithfulness is that shield and buckler. And what that means is that not only is God going to defend his own because he loves them, he's going to do it because his own name is involved in it. And if he didn't defend them, it would be a slur against his own faithfulness. Because don't forget, when God entered into covenant with his people, it was totally of his own volition that he did it. He didn't have to do it. He wasn't under obligation to do it. He did it because he's gracious. But having entered into that covenant relationship with his people, he, as it were, bound himself to be gracious to them, to always do them good. And so to fail to do that would be to cast a slur on his own name. And incidentally, understanding that, that's why some of the old Puritans used to speak in terms of suing God when they were seeking solace in his promises. And they'd speak back to God. They'd remind God of what he promised. They'd speak in terms of taking him to court on the basis of his own promises to which he must remain faithful to. Well, that's very bold, isn't it, for a man to speak like that against God or to God? But the boldness of these Puritans wasn't a kind of foolish threat or demand. And nobody who's read or understood these men's writings would ever dare to suggest that they were in any sense irreverent to God. Rather, their suing was a self-reminder to believe that God is faithful. To remember, if you like, from a theological perspective, that God is, and in a sense that he must, always be true to his promises to be God. And whilst God never needs to be reminded of that, we often do. And these men took God at his word. They spoke of holding him to his promises at his word, and in that they were comforted in their faith as they remembered that God's promises can never fail lest God himself fail. And we ought to be learning to do that sort of thing. And especially so in this whole area of God's promises. Because the question of God's promises is so important to believers. And if you think about it, everything, absolutely everything we believe as Christians is based on God's promises. For instance, we were first and foremost, when we came to believe the gospel, however it was the Spirit had so ordered our lives up to that point, when we first came to believe the gospel, we believed that God was righteous and that we were sinners and left to ourselves that we were in trouble. And then somehow around that general time, the Spirit revealed to us the promise of God's Son to us as the only one who could help us. But that personal revelation to us, where faith was made effectual through rebirth, is something that was founded on the promises given long before we, or indeed our distant ancestors, ever drew breath. And so far as the uttered word, promise of the given Savior, the first instance reaches back and is grounded in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15, in the seed of the woman who would crush the serpent's head. That's where that first promise is seen in the Bible. And of course, since that first promise given, over and over again, an increasing clarity, that promise was reiterated over the course of the Old Testament and into the New Testament until finally that promise came to fruition and was fulfilled when God sent forth his Son, born of a woman. in and through his birth, his life, and sacrificial death as God's Son. And so passing from death to life, from blindness to sight, that transforming point is like the first cry of a newborn babe, expressing faith in God's promise concerning his Son, whom he gave for sinners. We came into salvation because of God's promise. But from that point, as newborn babes, as you've eagerly scoffed down the pure milk of God's word, every step that you've taken, whether you've sat down and analyzed it or not, every step you've taken has been influenced by the promises of God to you in his word. You draw near to God because you believe the promise that God is the rewarder of those who earnestly seek him. You seek to walk uprightly because you believe that God has called you to do so and has promised to abide with us as we abide with him. And you persevere in this narrow way, which seems contrary to the way that everyone else is heading, because you believe the promise that it's the way that leads to life and ultimately to eternal glory. And when you draw your last breath, if you have the presence of mind, you'll do that trusting the promise that today you will be with Christ in paradise, even as the thief on the cross was promised he would be. So in a very real sense, everything that motivates us as Christians from rebirth to death is based in one way or another on the promises of God. But then, while these are non-debatable promises concerning the gospel and the progress and holiness in a Christian's life, because these points are so clear that there's very, very little ambiguity about them. Whilst that's the case, what about the area of personal promises? What about when God graciously plants a promise in a person's heart with regard to some particular or personal issue? Like when he planted, for example, the promise of protection, long life, and seeing salvation from this psalm in my mother's heart. Or like the time of a cholera epidemic in 1854, when Charles Spurgeon, returning from yet another funeral he had to take, caught sight of a text of the psalm in the shoemaker's window. And he saw the 10th verse, "Because thou hast made the Lord thy habitation, there shall no evil befall me, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling." And on seeing that text, sometime later he wrote this: "The effect upon my heart was immediate. Faith appropriated the passage as her own. I felt secure, refreshed, girt with immortality. I went on with my visitation of the dying in a calm and peaceful spirit. I felt no evil, fear of evil, and I suffered no harm." What can we say about the personal promises that God gives to people like Charles Spurgeon? What about in the case of the psalmist here himself? Because we can't reasonably suggest the promises given here are universal, and that no believer is ever going to suffer any harm at all, or that every believer has some kind of divine covering that guards them from all harm and evil, because that would be a total and outright contradiction of what the Bible teaches. It would be to deny David's suffering through his life unto his very death. It would make a mockery of Job and the Apostle Paul's sufferings, not to mention the words of Jesus concerning the persecution of believers as an expected thing. And on that note, it would make a mockery of the church and its history as well, and the often persecuted church, So what do we say about these personal promises as the psalmist had here? Well, firstly, I think it's worth noting, saying, asserting that at times God does promise certain things to individuals. But I'm very careful to say that such a thing isn't a very common thing. But nevertheless, but even so, God does at times graciously deal on such a personal level with those who dwell in his shelter. In fact, as I try to understand, I'm sometimes struck, as no doubt you are as well, at how the psalms can turn in the same psalm from earnest entreating to thankfulness and praise, as if an answer for deliverance had already been somehow given to him there by special revelation, where it seems that a direct word of promise had been delivered to his heart. And that, like here in the case of Psalm 91, we see the same sort of thing, a personal promise, where he's assured of protection from, verse 3, unseen plots, the snare of the fowler. Verse 5, not merely night attacks, but the terror of the night, perhaps the fear of the unknown, anxious thoughts, black thoughts, a sense of panic. Attacks on the body, verse 5 again, the arrow that flies by day. And verse 6, the pestilence that stalks by night and the destruction that wastes. And since these promises can't be universal promises, they must have been particular promises given to the psalmist at a particularly dangerous and testing time in his life where he needed God's reassurance. Perhaps a time where he was presently being assaulted, or perhaps in anticipation of a situation he was going to face. Personally, as the leader of others, and to me that most rightly fits this context. It seems to me this is some kind of a divine commissioning or a promise after divine commissioning when this person was set aside for a great task and where God was assuring him that he would have nothing to fear as he undertook that task. So in terms of promises then, these are promises that are given to every, they are promises that are given to every believer, irrespective of their age or growth and grace. Those promises are spelled out to us, to each of us in the Bible. Those are gospel promises. And our place is to pursue them and to apply them in our everyday lives. Then there are also the personal promises. Promises somehow mysteriously planted by the Holy Spirit. Promises that aren't common or plainly written so that you can read them. Promises mostly given in or in anticipation of some circumstance, just like the psalmist. And that's something that we all need to be cautious about when people talk about such things. And yet at the same time, we ought not to just reject these things outright. After all, if we speak of believing the written promise when we came to be believers by the Spirit's working in our hearts, is it not conceivable that that same Spirit can enlighten our hearts directly, since he already dwells within us? At the end of the day, it's still the same, his same mysterious workings with us in our hearts, communing with us, and communing with God. Nevertheless, because these promises are so subjective, there's a danger of either believing what may be just wishful thinking, or a danger of fearing to believe at all for other reasons. And so we need to be very, very circumspect when we speak about God's promises. So we've considered the psalmist's shelter as a shelter, the almighty transcendent God, who is also the immanent and personal God, the gracious God. And we've sketchily mentioned that whatever context the message of Psalm was drawn out of, that the personal promise of protection was good because the one who made it is faithful to his word. And it's because of that that the psalmist can take God's promise to protect him to the bank and cash in the check. Because the strength and surety of the promise lies in God's faithfulness himself. Because if the promise fails, then God fails. And that can't happen because he's the sovereign Lord over all creation. So whether we speak of God's universal gospel promises or God's particular promises to believers in particular situations, the grounds and security for those promises are the same. They're in God himself. And so they can never fail. But I wonder if you've ever given thought as to why, apart from what we've already considered concerning God's faithfulness to himself, why, when God makes promises of anything at all, and that no matter how long it may take to fulfill that promise, that his promise once given is as good as done? Have you ever thought why? And the answer to that is all bound up in God's name. And essentially because God is God. Let me put it this way. We, each of us gathered here, are all creatures of time. And we all progress along time in a linear fashion. Unless we have someone amongst us like we did a few weeks ago, Darth Vader, or a Time Lord has sort of slipped into our midst. Apart from such, we are all creatures of time and we all progress along time in a linear fashion. We start life as a wrinkly, helpless little object. We live and we grow, always progressing along that linear line. When we get older, we probably begin to shrink a bit, and then we die. And that's our creaturely experience. And I guess, I suppose, in that time, we make many promises, and hopefully we fulfill most of them. But without doubt, we sometimes fail. And I suppose we mostly fail because of unforeseen circumstances. Forces greater than ourselves that resist our intentions to fulfill our promises. That's man. But with God Most High, time is his creation. He's not on that linear line. He's not bound by it. He's outside of it. And he's in control of time, just as he's in control of all the passing events in time. He knows the end from the beginning. David said, didn't he, in Psalm 139, he knows the words he's going to speak even before they're on his tongue. And he knows every day he will live, even before one of them comes to pass. That's amazing. But that, you see, is what omniscience means when we speak of God. It means he sees everything, past, present, and future, as if they are always ever before him. Always. Such knowledge is too high, said David. And so since God always sees everything constantly in eternity, when he promises anything in time, whether that be the promise of Genesis 3:15 and the centuries it would take to bring that promise to fulfillment in his son, or whether it be the promise to protect from falling bombs and to satisfy with long years, or whether it be the promise to protect from cholera, as with Spurgeon, God's promises in time he has already seen as accomplished in eternity, as the all-seeing, omniscient God. They're not future to him. He's already seen it. It's in his presence. And something of that the Apostle Paul hinted at in Romans chapter 4 and verse 17, where he said, spoke of the God who gives life to the dead and called things that are not as though they are. Or that God sees, if you like, what is yet as though it is. He sees things before they take place in our linear time. So when he promises something beforehand, he doesn't, like us, have to then go about and to try and find a way to make that promise happen. No, he sees it with his omniscient eyes already being. And in a sense, his promise is in retrospect to what hasn't happened as yet, but is already before him. And he just lets us know. It's a gracious condescension. But then remember, apart from the fact that God is omniscient and sees all of these things and therefore can, if we could say confidently, promise them, having seen them. Remember also that this omniscient God is also the omnipotent God, who can do whatever he pleases with his creation. Because he's the one who created and the one who rules over all the things in this time. And so the psalmist, and indeed all who dwell in the shelter of God's wings, he's also the immanent and personal God. The God who has graciously bound himself to his people through his universal promise to do them good to the very end, and then on to eternity, and who at times graciously encourages his people to that end by assuring us in the most intimate of ways when he reveals things that are not yet as though they are. That's why you can bank on God's promises and why God's promises will never fail. Do you know him? Have you come to know him through faith in his Son? Because if you do, then you'll abide in his shadow. And whilst you may have to suffer for a little while, ultimately any suffering that you or I endure is determined by him and only for our good. Nothing will befall you or I without his determining it, because he's promised that. And you can take that to the bank, because God is always faithful to his promises. Amen.